been there for her. I need to make sure she's okay and let her know I'm thinking about her. It's really important.
I'm sorry.
Isabel had already gotten halfway to the door, and she turned back.
I'm sorry. There's just no way.
This had turned out to be a bad time to ask, given that Isabel was in a hurry to get to this meeting. But Lawrence was committed. Please, Isabel. I just want... need... to talk to her a moment. Really.
We're on total lockdown here. This whole campus is full of people who want to talk to their loved ones. I don't know if you've been following the state of the world out there, but it's total chaos. We can't trust anybody.
Isabel, I've never asked you for anything before.
Lawrence let a little of his desperation and dislocation show in his voice, and then had to struggle to keep it from overwhelming him.
Keep calm. Make your case. I've been your friend my whole life, and now I'm asking you for something that's massively important to me. Like, this could make the difference between me having a life and not having a life.
So she's the one, huh? Isabel shut the door and smiled. I thought Serafina was the one.
So did I. But, you know, the heart isn't a lie detector, or something. Falsely identifying the one is part of how you find the one.
He squelched a Matrix joke. I guess so. Isabel gave another tragic smile. I wouldn't know. I married my college boyfriend.
Lawrence didn't point out that Isabel and Percival had stayed together nearly 15 years, which was a pretty respectable run. Instead, Lawrence just waited, with arms folded, and what he hoped was a decently pathetic look on his face. Isabel held out a second longer, then handed him a phone.
But I have to stay and listen, for security reasons. I'm sorry.
That's fine. Lawrence seized the phone with both hands and dialed Patricia's last known number. It rang, while Isabel watched him, and rang some more, and went to voicemail. He dialed again. Same result. This time, Lawrence let it beep. He breathed, trying not to look at Isabel.
Hey, it's Lawrence. I just wanted to make sure you were okay. And also, just to say that I'm really sorry about your loss. Your parents, I mean. They were... I can't even begin to say. There's nothing I can say. I wish I could be there for you, in person.
He wasn't sure what else to say, on her voicemail, without being able to hear her response. Anything he could think of seemed inadequate, or maybe insensitive. He almost just hung up and handed the phone back to Isabel, but then he realized he'd just been looking at a freaking wormhole generator. A working model. He had no way of knowing what might happen next. They were, all of them, standing on Terra Incognita, and this felt like a moment that was radically discontinuous with everything that had come before. There was a non-trivial chance these were the last words he would ever speak to Patricia. So Lawrence pretended Isabel wasn't there, staring. And he said, "Listen, I meant it when I said I loved you. It just sort of came out, but it was the truth coming out. There's a huge, vital part of me that reaches out to you in some kind of emotional phototropism. I have so many things I want to say to you, and I wish our lives could wrap around each other forever. I can't go anywhere right now. I have to see something through. But I promise you, as soon as I'm free, I will track you down and we will be together. And I will try my fuckedest to make up for all the comfort I'm not giving you right now. That's a promise. I love you. Goodbye." He hung up with the flat of his thumb and handed the phone back to Isabel. She seemed pretty overcome by a grab bag of emotions.
Isabel put her hand on Lawrence's upper arm as she slipped the phone back into a hiding place in her purse. But all she said was, "Tell nobody about this phone." Lawrence nodded. Milton surveyed a roomful of geeks from his Herman Miller throne, ankle crossed over thigh and lips pursed as if he'd just finished a slice of the tartest Meyer lemon pie. Lawrence stumbled over the limbs of a dozen of his colleagues, seeking a corner of a beanbag to occupy. Someone gave up his folding chair for Isabel. They were in an old server room, with no windows and only one thick door, so it would be hard to eavesdrop. Nobody was talking, and Lawrence realized they were in the middle of one of Milton's dramatic pauses. As soon as Lawrence got settled, Milton restarted in the middle of an unfinished sentence about the crisis in the U.S. government, the possibility of a new civil war, martial law, the deteriorating international situation in the absence of American military resolve, all the ways this could soon turn to hellshit. Something in Milton was pessimistic to the point of brokenness, and yet he was usually right. Listening to Milton's dark litany, Lawrence felt a surge of affection for the nearly bald man with his moth-wing eyebrows. Part of Lawrence still wanted to be Milton Dirth when he grew up. "All of our unpaid bills are coming due at once," Milton was saying. Lawrence and Saugata kept looking at each other and half-grinning, because as soon as Milton got done talking about the collapse of civilization, he would move on to the fact that they had actually built it, the machine, and it seemed like it might work. Milton wanted to remind them all of the reasons why this could be humanity's last hope. And then they would get on to the good part. "All of this just makes this project even more urgent than we already thought," said Milton. "Isabel, where are we with that?"
"Very preliminary tests on the equipment are looking good," said Isabel. "It could be months before we're ready to try anything more serious. Meanwhile, the most promising exoplanet candidate continues to be KOI-232.04. The Shatner Space Telescope has gotten some very promising readings as it transits its star, and we know it has oxygen and liquid water. And we're pretty sure that if we create a stable wormhole with an opening near to KOI-232.04's gravity well, the mouth of the wormhole will be drawn down to the planet's surface. But there's no guarantee it would be pulled down onto solid land." Lawrence couldn't believe they were talking about visiting another planet. This was really, really happening. He kept falling off his half-beanbag with the giddiness. Every time Isabel said something about the evidence for KOI-232.04's habitability and the other exoplanet candidates they'd identified, he had to sit on his hand to keep from pumping his fist. Even with so many people dead and dying, even with the world on the edge of ruin, this was straight up amazing.
"Thank you for that update." Milton stared into his own laptop for a moment, then he looked up in every direction at once. "There's been a wrinkle. Ernest Mather has been running some numbers, and he has a, let's say, a concern. Ernest, can you share your findings with the group?" Mather looked as though he'd been through a lot since Lawrence dropped out of the sky and bought his company. He'd cut off his exuberantly frizzy hair and started wearing chunky engineer glasses. His shoulders were permanently hunched as he sat on a stool.
"I have done the math about 2,000 times, and there's, well, a possibility. Let's put it between 10% and 20%. A possibility that if we turn this machine on, we'll start a reaction that would lead to an anti-gravity cascade, which in turn could tear the Earth apart."
"But tell them the good news," Milton said quickly.
The good news?
Yes, the good news. Ernest did his best to sit up straight.
First, we would probably have about a week between turning the machine on and the Earth being obliterated.
So, with efficient crowd control, we could get a lot of people through the gateway before Earth was gone.
And there's around a 50% chance that if the destructive reaction started, we could stop it by turning the machine off.
So, said Milton, let's say it's a 10% chance of the destructive reaction starting, and a 50-50 chance that we could avert a catastrophic outcome in that case. In fact, it might only be a 5% chance of planetary rupture, or a 95% chance that everything would be fine. So, let's discuss. Lawrence felt like he'd jumped off that high gantry instead of taking the elevator. He wondered if he should have found a way to warn more people about what happened to Priya. Everybody was trying to talk at once, but all Lawrence could make out was Saugata's cursing. Lawrence looked at Isabel, whose folding chair wobbled as she hugged herself, and he wouldn't swear she wasn't crying. With no windows and the door sealed tight, the room seemed even more airless than it had before, and Lawrence had an irrational panic that he would step outside this room and find the whole outside world erased, gone for good. Ernest Mather was weeping into a wad of paper towels, even though he alone had known about this bombshell in advance. Maybe because he'd been processing the information for longer, he was readier to cry over it. Lawrence couldn't believe it was going to end like this. How was he going to keep Isabel from falling to pieces? The room was full of declarations. Someone quoted Oppenheimer, quoting the Bhagavad Gita. Tanea said even a 1% chance of blowing up the planet was too much.
We always knew there were risks, Tanea said, but this is insane.
Here's the thing, said Milton, when the initial outrage had died down. This technology was always a last resort. We went into this knowing we were leaping into the dreadful darkness, and I give you all my word, this technology will never see use unless we all judge that the human race is past the brink of self-destruction.
He paused again. Everybody inspected his or her hands.
The sad truth is, there is a strong possibility our entire species is hosed unless we act. It's all too easy to imagine a number of different scenarios in which conflicts escalate to the point where doomsday weapons are unleashed, or a total environmental collapse happens. If we see an overwhelming likelihood of that happening, and if we have confidence that we can keep a wormhole open for long enough to transport a sustainable population, then we have a duty to proceed.
Nobody spoke for a while, as everybody chewed on this.
Anya was the one who decided to jump straight to being process-oriented. What kind of safeguards or guarantees do we put in place to make sure the device isn't activated unless we're all convinced the world is in a near-doomsday situation?
Ernest wanted to know just how many people they could hope to gather at short notice and send through the portal in the time it remained open. Not to mention supplies. Could they have a whole colony's worth of people and material stashed someplace nearby for the green light? Could they attempt to fly in people from other parts of the world to maintain a diverse gene pool in lieu of their original plan to build identical machines all over the planet?
Let's not derail into talking about logistics, said Tanea. We're still on the ethical question.
There is no ethical question, said Jerome, another engineer who wore tight braids and a collarless shirt. As long as we all agree it won't be used unless the world is for certain doomed, that's clear-cut. We have a moral imperative to prepare a safeguard.
Milton was sitting back and letting them all argue, either waiting for them to come around to his point of view on their own,
or else watching for the right opening to seize control again. Meanwhile, they were suffocating, sitting on folding chairs or beanbags, while Milton had an air on. Lawrence flinched at the thought that history was being made in this disused server room, which was acquiring a sour cabbage odor.
"I don't think anybody in this room is qualified to make the decision we're attempting to take on here," said Saugata.
"And there's someone somewhere else who is?" said Jerome.
"Even if there's no disaster," someone said, "what if the planet is uninhabitable within a few decades?"
They started talking ocean acidification, atmospheric nitrogen, food web collapse.
"What if we're only 80% sure it's the apocalypse?" someone else asked.
Lawrence tried to hear the ghost of Patricia that he had been keeping in his head since they'd been separated. What would Patricia be saying if she were here? He couldn't imagine. She didn't even believe ethics were derived from universal principles, like the greatest good for the greatest number.
She seemed farther away than ever, as though he'd already gone to a different planet than her. But then it hit him.
They were talking about maybe condemning Patricia to death, along with billions of others, on the assumption that they were all doomed anyway.
He couldn't even picture himself starting to unspool that for Patricia.
Lawrence opened his mouth to say that of course they should pull the plug. This was insane.
But at that moment, he caught sight of Isabel, who had stopped rocking in her chair and now looked just immobilized. Isabel's eyes were furrowed, and she was inhaling through her nose with her lips pulled inward, and you could almost believe she was about to bust out laughing. Her dishwater bob was getting shaggy, and her white wrists were like saplings. Isabel looked so breakable.
Lawrence felt a stabbing cardiothoracic pain, like a more grinding version of a panic attack, at the thought of hurting Isabel. Then he flipped the question around in his head. He tried to imagine how he'd feel if humanity really did run out of hope in a year or 10, and they didn't have this radical option to offer. How would he explain that to some hypothetical person in this apocalyptic panic?
"We might have had a solution, but we were too scared to pursue it."
"We can't give up now," Lawrence heard himself say. "What I mean is, we can carry on with the research for now, in the hopes that we'll find a way to make it totally safe. And we can all agree we won't even test the machine unless things look really, really bad. But if it comes down to a choice between the whole human race dying out in some nuclear holocaust or total environmental collapse, and a few 100,000 people making it to a new planet, that's no choice at all, right?"
Milton was nodding, with his arms folded. Isabel snapped back to life with a gasp, as though he'd done CPR on her just in time. Lawrence expected someone else to jump in and argue with him, but everybody was hanging on his words for some weird reason. So Lawrence said,
"As long as humanity survives, the best part of planet Earth will have endured. I mean, you wouldn't do anything without a backup plan, right? So this is just our backup plan, in case Plan A fails."
They'd been meeting a few hours, and people were starting to come together behind the notion of developing the wormhole generator as an absolute last resort, especially since the alternative was just packing up and going home and waiting for the worst to happen. At last, Milton spoke up again.
"Thank you, all of you, for sharing your perspectives. This isn't going to be an easy decision to make, and we're not going to finish making it today. For now, though, I hope we can all agree to keep moving forward, with safeguards in place, as Anya suggested, to keep the device from being activated without overwhelming likelihood of a true doomsday occurrence. But I will say this. I believe it's coming. The only question in my mind is the timescale,
It could be 6 months or 60 years. But at some point, if things keep going along these vectors, we will be in a place where we are poised to end ourselves. We can only hope there will be enough warning before it happens to allow us to get some people out. The exact nature of the safeguards was left vague. Everybody left the server room, reeling with tension headaches and moral torment. Tanea and Jerome rushed off to the storage closet, the only place with privacy in the entire compound, for some emergency nookie. For everybody else, there was a pleasant surprise. Someone had delivered 2 dozen pizzas while they'd been debating the fate of the world. Nobody had eaten pizza in months, since they got to Denver. Lawrence grabbed 3 wide slices, folding the first slice lengthwise and stuffing it in his mouth. The sun had gone down, and the one tree on the front lawn of the Industrial Park campus was making an evil silhouette against the outsized moon. Lawrence ended up changing seats so he could eat pizza with his back to the big window, but he could still feel the world breathing down his neck. He looked over at Isabel, and she nodded at him, with one eye half shut in a kind of minimalist smile. Chapter 26. Weeds pushed out of all the cracks in the walls the moment Ernesto broke the magical seals on the entrance to danger and took his first steps out onto the landing. Patricia and Kawashima had spent hours disinfecting and defoliating the landing and stairs, and their efforts didn't seem to have made any difference. Fungus blossomed and spread until the floor was squishy and the ceiling sagged with the added weight. Ernesto smiled, unsteady, and grew a beard of green. The seeds and spores on his hands sprouted, and greenery came out of every seam or opening on his embroidered suede vest, clean white shirt, and gray flannel pants. His white-streaked hair turned dark. Stems and leaves obscured his face.
"Crud," Kawashima said. "We need to move fast. Help him down the stairs."
Patricia did her part, but Ernesto could barely walk, even with 2 people, shielded by protective spells, supporting him. And the stairs had gotten treacherous, with vines and bracken coming up through all the crevices. Patricia already felt bogged down by a mixture of weariness, guilt, and anger, since she hadn't slept in weeks, and her mind was overtaxed with trying not to obsess about the same 2 or 3 things. Everything was hopeless. People were drowning in death everywhere, and Patricia felt like a selfish monster every time she dwelt on her own personal shit. Like her parents, which, whatever, she hadn't been close to them, in spite of their recent weak attempts at fence-mending. And Lawrence, who had randomly declared his love for her and then gone missing for months, just when she'd opened up to someone and started to feel like maybe she was worthy of love after all. She shouldn't obsess about these things, because there was no fixing them, and people needed her to be present. Like Ernesto, who was about to tumble down the overgrown stairs while she was wallowing. The banisters were mossy, and the stairs were growing branches. Patricia and Kawashima gave up on supporting Ernesto and just carried him down, 2 stairs at a time. They reached the final flight just as the staircase burst open and erupted with shrubbery. Patricia and Kawashima jumped over the rising branches in unison and reached the bottom step, with Patricia supporting Ernesto's head and Kawashima holding his legs. Ernesto was a green man. Patricia could feel her own clothes growing a layer of gunk. The VW Jetta that they'd spent a week enchanting for Ernesto idled out front, with Dorothea honking the horn every few seconds. They jumped over roots and branches in the vestibule and ducked under the low-hanging vines in the doorway. The sidewalk cracked the moment Ernesto came near it, as long-buried jacarandas crashed upwards, casting trumpet flowers everywhere.
Patricia shoved Ernesto in the back of the Jetta and got in next to him. She and Kawashima slammed the passenger side doors, and Dorothea sped toward the freeway before anybody had their seatbelt on. The bridge was closed. There was a wreck. They had to veer off and head for the Dumbarton. People had set fire to a bank, and the fire had spread to other buildings. Black smoke over Soma. Patricia closed her eyes. On the radio, the president fizzed about plans and resolutions, but Congress couldn't even convene because nobody could agree on temporary chambers, and it was a constitutional nightmare. Next to Patricia, Ernesto sloughed vegetation until he looked human again. Trapped in the car with three other witches, Patricia felt desperately alone. Her eyes stung from lack of sleep, and her body felt like it was cannibalizing itself. She only wished she could go all the way feral from sleep deprivation and devolve to a lower state of consciousness, shut her higher brain down, because there was no way to think without obsessing, and she was absolutely not going to do that. Ever since Superstorm Allegra hit, Ernesto and Kawashima had been sending her out on missions constantly, and it had almost kept her distracted enough. People were in trouble and needed a discreet helping hand. Other people were being predators and needed to be devoured by flesh-eating bacteria. Patricia had gotten so she could inflict flesh-eating bacteria in her sleep, if she ever slept. Now, in this car, she had nothing to do but sit with her thoughts, and it was unbearable. The only person she wanted to talk to was Lawrence, who had dropped a bomb on her and then disappeared with no explanation. Sometimes she felt as though she had had a chance at happiness and self-acceptance dangled in front of her, and then snatched away. But that was the most selfish notion of all. The last time Patricia had dreamed of the forest, there was a hailstorm, so sharp it nicked your face, and every hailstone was a frozen fish with a look of terror on its face. The razor-sharp fish sliced at Patricia's skin and tore her clothes until she staggered through the icy woods, wearing just her underwear and some cowboy boots. Her blood froze as it came off her. She skittered on the frosty ground as the hail grew heavier and heavier, and fish piled up around her bare ankles. At last, she came to the great magic tree, which was no kind of tree she could identify, and she threw herself on its base, crying for protection as the rain of tiny fish came thicker. She looked out from the shelter of the tree and saw nothing but skeletons in all directions, not just dead trees, but dead creatures of all kinds, animal skeletons and human skulls and leafless, petrified trees, as far as she could see. The only signs of life, herself, and the great shape she huddled under. Patricia's increasingly unreliable phone seemed to have lost signal for good once they'd set off on the road, but she could still pull up the cryptic email she'd gotten from Lawrence right after Superstorm Allegra, saying only that he had to go off the grid for a while and not to worry about him. All along the roadside, people stood holding signs that begged for a ride or a job or some food. They passed a mall that looked like it had been burnt and torn apart, and then burnt a second time. Near Vacaville, there was a blocked-off exit where the sign said, "Town Closed. Quarantine." Patricia glimpsed plumes of smoke off in the distance. Coming from a distant hillside, where the trees or someone's fields were on fire. There shouldn't be this many fires so close to Christmas. The sheer volume of bad news had gotten beyond anybody's ability to process into a narrative. Everybody knew people back east who had died in the flood or succumbed to diseases in the refugee camps, and a ton of people couldn't get at the money they'd deposited in one of the banks that had gone belly up. Almost everybody knew people who were living through the Arab winter or the Irish famine. Patricia had spent days trying to reach her ex-boyfriend Samir to make sure he hadn't gotten caught up in the violence in Paris. After a while in the car, Patricia suffocated, but she couldn't crack a window, or Ernesto would grow weeds again. Taylor had fallen asleep with headphones on, behind the driver's seat. Dorothea was telling a story about a woman who built a house in the middle of a never-ending landslide, and her story made their car go 300 miles per hour. Kawashima was busy driving. The only one Patricia could talk to was Ernesto, who kept almost touching her, in between pointing out all the things that had changed in the 40 years since he'd been outside.
"And most days, the house rocked like a boat," Dorothea said to Kawashima from the front seat. "You don't need a porch swing if you live on a bottomless landslide."
Maybe all of this suffering was Patricia's fault. 2 years after Diantha had led that assault in Siberia, the pipe and passage had suffered an accident. The borehole had started gushing methane into the atmosphere, a near-invisible geyser, and the satellite images were everywhere on the Internet for a few years. Global temperatures had spiked soon after. Maybe if they'd succeeded in stopping the project, none of this would have happened. Or maybe Patricia's EMP had dealt the people in Siberia just enough of a setback that they'd cut some corners to get back on schedule. And there would have been no accident if Patricia hadn't disrupted things. Maybe Patricia killed her parents. If she could explain that theory to Lawrence, he would laugh at her. He'd have some reasonable explanation for how she couldn't possibly blame herself. At least not any more than everyone else on Earth. Lawrence would spout facts about methane cathrates and the inevitability of those planetary farts getting released. He would point out the fault lay with Lamar Tucker and his crew, who decided to drill for methane in the first place. He would say something random and weird to snap her out of it. Whereas if she shared her theory with Ernesto or the others, they would just tell her blaming herself for the world's problems was pure aggrandizement. But her actions in Siberia had been pure aggrandizement, too. She tried talking to Ernesto about her sense that we had broken nature. Nature was a delicate balance, and we, people generally, had messed it up. Ernesto's response,
"We could not break nature if we spent a million years trying. This planet is a speck, and we are specks on a speck. But our little habitat is fragile, and we cannot live without it."
Lawrence telling Patricia that he loved her, and then vanishing, it felt way too much like those birds telling Patricia she was a witch, and then giving her the silent treatment when she was a child. Except she couldn't have any faith that this declaration would come true, the same way the first one had. Magic was always bound to claim her in the end, in retrospect, but love was the most susceptible to random failure of all human enterprises. Lawrence had always been preoccupied with his mysterious, weird experiments that he kept working on even after that accident. And any relationship was probably always going to come second for him. In her darkest moments, she imagined Lawrence shuddering and rolling his eyes in that way that he sometimes did, as he recollected how he'd almost dated his loony friend.
"Do you know why the tricksters and the healers went to war 200 years ago?
Ernesto asked Patricia, just as she was starting to spiral into obsession, in spite of herself. She said.
"Because they had different approaches to magic."
"They witnessed the Industrial Revolution,"
Ernesto said.
"They saw the sky turn black. The dark satanic mills, the great factories. The healers
feared the world would be choked to death, so they set out to break all the machines. The tricksters opposed them, because they believed none of us had the right to impose our will on everyone else. Their conflict almost destroyed everything.
So what happened? Patricia whispered.
Taylor had woken up and was listening too, fascinated.
After Hortense Walker made a peace between them, they reached a compromise. That is where our rule of aggrandizement comes from, that none of us will try to shape the world too much. But also, they started working on a failsafe, which I hope we never have to use. And now, perhaps you understand why we were so concerned about you these past months.
Patricia nodded. It made sense now. If she made any of this about her, she would only screw up again. Ernesto was right. She should just try to be a speck on a speck. So instead, she held on tight to her anger, even as she choked on the recycled air in the car. Patricia had no time for grief, blame, or a broken heart. But anger, there was endless time for.
Stay angry. Hold on to it. Anger is your tightrope over the abyss.
She repeated in her head what she said right after the storm hit.
Some fucker had to pay.
Kawashima had been vague about their destination, but now that they were zipping through Utah at 300 miles per hour, he opened up.
We're going to be proactive. We're going to stage an intervention for the planet.
He paused, and Patricia was on tenterhooks. Then Kawashima explained at last.
There are some maniacs outside Denver building a doomsday device which will tear a hole in the planet, and we're going to deal with it.
Patricia was ready.
Let it come.
Chapter 27. Lawrence had lunch with Milton. Just the two of them. No Isabel, no other members of Lawrence's team.
I remember when I first saw you, when you were a little boy, Milton said. Youngest person ever to build a 2-second time machine.
He smiled and reached for another piece of fried chicken from the bucket on the floor between them. They were sitting on the carpet of the main office on the top floor. The chicken was perfectly crispy and gushed with juice inside its bread shell, and Lawrence's fingers still felt pristine after two pieces. The bucket had the name of some local fry shop on it. How did Milton keep conjuring up fast food? Even for a billionaire, this was a coup. Lawrence sensed Milton was making some late-in-the-game effort to bond. They were listening to Robert Johnson, the only music Milton liked.
The 2-second time machine.
Lawrence wiped his fingers, even though there was no need. Classic example of a useless device.
Well, yes and no.
Dearth shrugged with his whole torso.
It was a badge of membership in a select group, right? But also, an object lesson. Imagine if you could build a device that goes backward 2 seconds, instead of forward 2 seconds. But you couldn't stop yourself from pressing it over and over.
You'd be stuck in a loop, Lawrence said. The same 2 seconds forever.
From where Lawrence sat on the floor, he could just see the treetops of the forest on the other side of the feeder road from the industrial park. They shook like pom-poms.
We could be stuck in a 2-second time loop right now and never know it, said Dearth. Except that it's already been 2 seconds since I said that. But yeah, think about it, man. The same device, harmless if you go one direction, but potentially disastrous if you go the other way. Sometimes things have a grain that you have to go with. You can't swim against the tidal wave.
And history, said Lawrence,
maybe seeing where Milton was going with all this. History is a tidal wave. Lawrence glanced out the window again, and this time he could see not just the tops of those trees, but the branches and some of the trunks. They were waving at him. He thought maybe if he did a good job of bonding with Milton, he would let Lawrence out to take a walk in the woods. It would make Lawrence feel closer to Patricia.
History is just the flow of time writ large, man, Milton said.
Lawrence reached for another piece of chicken, then glanced up to see the trees from across the road. He could see way more of their trunks now.
Get down!
Lawrence threw himself on top of Milton on the floor, just as a branch, as wide as his ribcage, shot through the window and into the far wall. In seconds, the room was crammed with leaves and branches. Lawrence couldn't see the walls or any of the desks, just dense, heavy, spiky green. Lawrence crawled on his belly toward the open doorway. From behind him, Milton said,
"What the hell is..."
And Lawrence just shrugged, since he couldn't say anything without losing his voice forever. He had enough presence of mind to bite his tongue. From downstairs, Lawrence heard the firecracker laugh of a machine gun. Someone screamed in pain and fear. The guards were shouting for backup and more and bigger weapons. Lawrence reached the door that led from the main office and got to his feet. He had fried chicken skin stuck to his knee. He ran to the other side of the building, where there was still clear space and he could see out the window. Standing in the disabled parking spot was Patricia's friend, Dorothea, wearing a floor-length floral skirt and Birkenstocks. He could just hear her chatting about a grandmother who left one of her grandchildren at the seaside, another at the edge of the desert, and a third at the foot of the mountains, and the grandmother couldn't remember which child she had left where. Lawrence guessed that Ernesto, the guy whose touch supercharged anything organic, was somewhere in the middle of the assault of trees.
"Mr. Durth, sir."
A couple of guys in all black outfits with big guns slung over one shoulder came running into the big office.
"There's been some kind of attack. We need to get you out of here."
"Screw me," Durth said. "Protect the machine. That's what they're here for."
Lawrence was still staring down at Dorothea. A man sprinted toward Dorothea, shooting his semi-automatic to no effect. When the man reached Dorothea, his head separated from his neck, as if she had a razor-sharp whip. The man fell one way, his head rolled the other. Lawrence looked down at the dead body and hesitated 1 second longer. Then he turned toward Milton.
"You're going to want a white noise machine," Lawrence said. "Something so she can't hear herself speak."
Lawrence waited to be struck dumb, but apparently he hadn't broken his promise.
"What do you..." the man with the gun said.
"The fabrication machine," Milton said. "It's near where she is. Turn on the goddamn fabricator."
Lawrence took off running. He ignored Milton yelling after him and the men with the guns shouting for him to stop. Once in the stairwell, he took the stairs three at a time. He made for the bright exit, shouting,
"Patricia!"
Dorothea recognized Lawrence as he came out into the parking lot. She nodded at him, but didn't stop talking about the grandmother and the lost children. Lawrence waved at her and kept running around the side of the building. Around Dorothea's feet lay the headless bodies of four men. The fabricator turned on just as Lawrence was 10 yards away, near the tiny window to his own lab. It was a deafening clatter, and for the first time Dorothea looked flustered. She kept trying to talk, but she stumbled over a word, and then another. Lawrence didn't hear the gunshot over the noise of the fabricator, but he saw the back of Dorothea's head go out. She fell, so she was almost touching the bodies of her own kills. Nobody thought to turn off the fabrication machine, so the air was still filled with churn. Lawrence stared at the dead body in the long, flowy skirt for a moment, remembering when he'd eaten tacos with her. Then he thought about the fact that Patricia had to be here someplace, and took off running again. Patricia was rising off the ground. Lawrence had thought she couldn't fly, but there she was. She floated on the wind, like a balloon that some kid had lost hold of at the fairground. Patricia was so close to Lawrence, closer than she'd been in months, but he had no way to get to her. He called out, but she couldn't hear him over the white noise. He screamed her name until his voice was shot. Patricia looked peaceful. Her arms spread a little, like a snow angel. Her feet pointed down. She wore no shoes. Her socks had pom-poms over the heels. Her shadow fell right over Lawrence's eyes, and her path converged with the gantry that had the precious wormhole machine on it. He tried to get her attention, but she was too far away now. By the time Patricia reached the top, she was a dot. But what happened next was easy to see from the ground. Lightning poured out of the sky, from a cloud that hadn't been there a moment earlier. Slash after slash, until smoke floated down. The light blinded him, but he couldn't look away, and he screamed Patricia's name with his hoarse, smoke-singed throat. Lawrence could barely stand because he felt like his center of gravity was being crushed by seeing her dear shadow against the hideous white glare. Cinders and twisted pieces of the wormhole machine rained down and nearly hit Lawrence's hot, wet face.
Book 4 Chapter 28 Everybody was singing madrigals, tight, staggered harmonies that rang with a lightness that had sharp pieces of melancholy embedded in it. Quartets, quintets, and bigger groups went door to door in residential areas, or barged into bare-bones eateries, holding sheet music and wearing modest black linen-cotton outfits. A pitch pipe sounding a single note was your only warning that your heart was about to be wrecked. Now is the month of Maying. O Mort! Even crazy Carlo Gesualdo. People would stop whatever they were doing and listen to madrigals until they were tear-soaked. Something about the way the trebles and altos would introduce a soaring melodic line, and then the tenors or basses would come in to fuck it up, was like the musical knife twist you never saw coming. After the flood, everyone agreed that madrigals were the soundtrack of our lives. Dee Dee dropped out of her ska punk band and joined an 8-person madrigal chorus. She had a clot somewhere deep inside her that was connected to the people she had lost in the flood, or might lose in the aftermath, and the endless conversations where everybody compared notes on their respective tragedies only made her feel shittier. Just saying the words, "My brother is still missing," made Dee Dee want to throw up and then headbutt whoever had asked. She needed an alternative to the dull repetition of facts. A way to share her uncut heartbreak without any particulars. And to her amazement, she found it in these strange old songs about doomed lovers. She was heading for the door after putting on her white blouse and black skirt from an old waitress gig, plus black high tops, and she found herself staring at Patricia's empty bedroom. A matter-of-fact off-white rectangle, it looked smaller without furniture. Scars in the wall and floor where a bed had dug in. Patricia had reappeared after being gone for a few weeks, taking care of some business in Denver, and she'd seemed really content, as if whatever demons had sent her out until near dawn every night had been cleansed at last. Sitting with Dee Dee and Racheline for hours on that old sofa, Patricia had craned her long neck and listened to all their stories and fears, and somehow always said the exact right thing. Dee Dee's chorus rang the doorbell, and she rushed down to join them as they took to the rave-dark streets.
The electricity kept turning off, and the people who still had jobs were going over to a 4-day work week, because PG&E, only for sure, guaranteed power Monday through Thursday. Worse yet, the Hetch Hetchy water kept getting diverted, and you never knew if the taps would turn on or not. Half the shops on Valencia were boarded. Dee Dee's tights and skirt itched. Her throat felt dry. She did vocal exercises under her breath, and her fellow mezzo, Julianne, laughed in sympathy. The group walked past a house that was on fire, and the neighbors were putting it out with buckets. The smoke got in Dee Dee's throat. But then they got to a cafe crammed with people holding hands and drinking simple coffee from a tureen, and started to sing, and Dee Dee found the music carrying her, same as always. Racheline had always been the mom of the apartment, being the master tenant and years older. But post-flood, Patricia had usurped her. Because Racheline couldn't cope, even more than most people couldn't cope. And Patricia had seemed to be made of coping. Some people just rise to a crisis. Dee Dee and Racheline had kept saying to each other in wonder, "Thank goodness Patricia is here." Patricia had floated, effortless, and after a while they hadn't even needed to ask for her to solve everything for them. They couldn't believe this was the same girl who'd thrown hot bread at them. After they were done singing, Dee Dee and her chorus hung around the cafe, accepting tips or presents. She found herself talking to an older gay man named Reginald, whose arms were covered with beautiful insect tattoos. "I suppose I identify with the silver swan who waits to sing until it's too late," said Reginald.
"It's never too late," Dee Dee said. "Come on, we're going to the next place, and I bet we'll find you another swan there."
"I should go home," Reginald said.
But then he paused halfway out the door, as if contemplating a return to an empty flat. Patricia had done something weird a few days before she had moved out. Dee Dee was washing her hands over and over, cursing into the steam cloud, and she'd looked up and seen Patricia's face behind her in the slicked mirror. Patricia had stared, the way Dee Dee imagined that a lover would watch you after sex, with a kind of ownership. Or the way you would survey a pet that you had just gotten done domesticating. Something about Patricia's look made Dee Dee's scalp itch.
"What are you..."
Dee Dee had spun around, hands bright red, but Patricia had vanished. There were shortages of HIV meds, along with everything else, and normally Reginald would have been in a silent panic. But Patricia had done something, and now Reginald was cured. At least, that's the word Patricia had used. Cured.
"You can't tell anyone."
He'd woken up in the middle of the night to see her leaning over his bed, two hands and one knee on the mattress, one foot on the ground. She wore a big black hoodie that only exposed a pointy white chin and a few strands of dark hair.
"I have to leave town, maybe forever," she said, "and I don't want to leave you in the lurch."
Patricia wouldn't explain why she had to leave town, much less how she had cured him. She just did something elaborate and non-invasive, kneeling at the foot of his bed, and Reginald smelled burnt radish for a moment.
"It's complicated,"
was all she would say, in a much older woman's voice, raspy, bitter.
"I've been called up to the front."
Reginald kept asking, "The front of what?" And then she was gone. Reginald had suspected the whole thing was a weird dream, but she'd left a long black hair on his floor, and, yes, his viral load had tested at absolute zero afterward. And now Reginald wasn't sure what to say to anyone he might have sex with. Dee Dee dragged Reginald to the Dover Club and introduced him to Percival, who was some kind of architect or something, with tousled gray hair and a doughy face like a British movie star from the 1970s. He even had the houndstooth vest. Percival was a Madrigal groupie, who followed the groups around using a caddy app and hung on every quaver.
My biggest fear about the apocalypse isn't being eaten by cannibals. It's the fact that in every other post-apocalyptic movie you see someone with an acoustic guitar by the campfire,
said Percival, who had pale, meaty hands with calluses on the sides of the fingers.
I can't stand acoustic guitar music. I'd rather listen to dub thrash.
There's no apocalypse, Reginald snorted. There's just a period of adjustment. People are being drama queens.
But even as he spoke, he had a vivid image of Patricia looming over his bed at 4 in the morning with an urgency in her hoarse voice that was indistinguishable from fear. Again, he wondered, the front of what? Every stone, every leaf of ivy, every iridescent window pane at El Tisley Hall rejected Diantha's presence. The grass at the center of the hex bristled at her. The chunky marble columns of the greater building drew themselves up like magistrates taking umbrage. The narrow gates of the lesser building seemed to squint, to deny her entrance. The chapel clenched granite and stained glass fists, their knuckles spiked with gargoyles. Across the hex, the big white slab of the residential wing turned opaque with mist. All 6 sides of the hex puffed with hostility. Healers had built this place centuries ago, and nobody does scorn like a pure healer. Diantha hadn't come back to El Tisley since she'd been allowed to graduate without distinction, and this was worse than she'd dreaded. She almost turned and ran, but she would only have gotten lost in the brambles and possibly eaten by something before she could have reached any kind of road. So instead, she made herself walk up the sharp steps to the greater building, where they were waiting for her in formal hall. She drew her thin black gown, with its yellow trim and ermine collar, tighter around herself against the sudden chill. Why had they demanded her presence when she was finally starting to build a life without magic? Diantha found an empty seat in formal hall, in the back corner, as far as possible from high table. Portraits of dead witches scowled from the dark walls, and chandeliers shuddered overhead. They were serving some kind of fish course, but the fish and the potatoes were the same mushy consistency. Someone tried to make small talk, but Diantha just kept her head down and pretended she was eating. Just when Diantha thought the whole ordeal couldn't get more miserable, she heard an inhuman chatter from the corridor outside, and they burst in. 12 of them, in their little suits and starchy dresses, singing madrigals. Fucking madrigals. Was there a more repulsive trend in the entire universe? Trust hipsters to make even the collapse of civilization unbearably twee. These were the advertising jingles of the Renaissance, written by wife-killers and creepy stalkers. Diantha wanted to scream, to drown them out with obscenities, to fling her fish-tatoes at them. Someone slipped an envelope onto the table, instructing Diantha to come to the upper common room for after-dinner sherry. The UCR wasn't the nest of luxury Diantha and the other students had always imagined, just a mahogany box with 7 leather armchairs and a crimson and jasmine carpet. The ceiling was a wooden grid, as were the walls. Everything tidy and regular, because this was El Tisley Hall. Another hand reached for the sherry at the same time as Diantha, and she recognized the slim white wrist even before she looked up into the face of Patricia Delphine. Patricia still looked the same, like an eager baby. She hadn't grown prematurely old the way Diantha had. Patricia smiled. She actually smiled at Diantha. The half-full sherry glass slipped from Diantha's grasp as Patricia poured for her, almost ruining the immaculate carpet. Patricia helped steady Diantha's hand. She resisted the urge to throw her drink in Patricia's face. Instead, she looked at her own feet. It's so weird to be back here after so long, Patricia said. Feels like a lifetime since we left, but also like we were just here yesterday. Like a spell that makes us both younger and older. I'm glad to see you again.
No, Patricia really had changed. She moved like a bodhisattva,